See all of you here for this very important forum. Welcome to New College. I also want to welcome folks who are listening to the live webcast. And thanks to Greg Wills, who's our technical person here at New College that makes the webcast possible. We are delighted, honored, privileged to have Huwaida and Adam speak here at New College. I'm sure you're all aware of the important, courageous, inspiring work that they've been doing in the occupied territories. And I'm sure all of us are here to lend our support for those important to learn more about what's going on and what we can do. My name is John Garfield. I work here at New College. I direct the Center for Education and Social Action, and also I'm faculty in the Studies MA program and the Activism and Social Change MA program. At this point, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Ted Lewis, who directs the human programs at Global Exchange. My pleasure to introduce Ted.
Thank you. I'm going to be really brief tonight. When about 3 weeks ago, Adam Shapiro called up and said that he was coming out to the Bay Area, I was very excited because knowing Adam and Huwaida, the courageous work that they've inspired in the occupied territories and the kind of approach that they have brought during the last year to a situation that many people look at and throw up their hands in despair. What the work that the ISM is doing, in addition to just the work on the ground, is the work hope to people, bringing hope in places where people are feeling hopelessness. That's the essential mission that I feel in the work that's going on with the International Solidarity Movement. That these two have been so essential in helping. During this last year, I think all of us know and have watched the situation in the Middle East and in Palestine and in Israel, but throughout the Middle East has become much more dangerous as our own country has made crucial steps in the wrong direction, at almost every level imaginable. We're at a point where we really have to take very strong stands against the policies of our governments, whether we be in the United States, in Israel, or in many other places in the world. So the ethic of nonviolence that inspires the International Solidarity Movement is something that also inspires me and I think inspires the work we're in this room. So Adam and Huwaida have plenty to say tonight and they can say it for themselves, so I just want everybody to give them a very hearty San Francisco welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Thank you for coming out to listen to us speak. I'm always humbled by what I hear people say, and I was just telling Ted on the way over here, one of the reasons I don't like speak communities is because I think people give us too much credit for what we're doing, and I don't think we deserve it at all. I think the people that deserve it are the day in Palestine. We're just doing the minimum to help keep giving people hope and a reason. Yesterday, I'm sure you all have heard, because I think all of the major media stations covered it, the double bombing in Tel Aviv, and 23 Israeli civilians, Israelis were killed. Last count, I heard about 100. And it's atrocious, the kind of And so we thought, to the extent that the situation has so deteriorated, there is no way the olive harvest would proceed without some kind of protection for Palestinians. And international civilians from all over answered our call and came. And they accompanied Palestinian farmers to their olive groves, and not without incident. Sometimes we were blocked by the military and told that we are not allowed to enter. This is closed area. Go home. And we protested, and there were sit-downs, and there were marches, and there were coming back the next day. And this was led by the Palestinians. We just accompanied them for protection and for support and to assure them that whatever's happening, we are watching and we are trying to get the information out. We were attacked by settlers, and we had Palestinians and internationals beaten. One 74-year-old James Delaplane had a rib broken, and subsequently one of his lungs collapsed. But he recovered, and he is out there speaking about what he witnessed and the importance of the need for international people all over the world. Despite what our government's doing, despite our foreign policy, we can't stay silent in the face of this. The international solidarity movement, I think one of the misconceptions is that it's this international body or force or organization that is coming in and that is conducting nonviolent direct action as if we're doing it for Palestinians. That's not the case. The ISM is led by Palestinians. Coordinators within our group are Palestinian. And what we call on internationals to come and do is very important. And I want to outline them for you so that you know, because I am calling on you tonight to not stay silent. And if you can't come, then to do other things. But the ISM was created in order to provide hope. Palestinians believe that the world is watching what's happening to them and not doing anything because Israel is too powerful. No one can hold Israel accountable for Palestinian lives. And if I'm to give you an example, just look at what happened in Jenin. In April of 2002, the Israeli army attacked Jenin by land and by air, firing missiles 24 hours a day into the Jenin refugee camp. 1 kilometer square refugee camp, 24 hours a day, Apache helicopters and F-16s flying overhead, and then the bulldozers and the tanks came in. And because the tanks couldn't fit into the narrow alleyways of the Jenin refugee camp, the bulldozers started working to demolish refugee homes. Over 400 homes were demolished. Thousands of people were left homeless. Hundreds of people, men mainly, disappeared. And the UN said the official count of those that were killed is 54, but there are so many more that are missing, we don't really know. And when the UN tried to come in and investigate the war crimes, Israel said no. And that was it. And so who is to hold Israel accountable? Doesn't the world see what's happening? This also contributes to a level of despair that has driven people to believe there is nothing we can do. And those people that have decided that the only way to fight back is to attack inside Israel, just like the Israeli army is attacking inside Palestine. Most in Palestinian society are not speaking out against it because they don't see another way. It's not that Palestinians are barbaric. You speak to any Palestinian and they tell you every child has a right to live. No civilians should be attacked. But they can't seem to point to another way. I originally went over to Palestine. I went to live in Jerusalem to work for a conflict resolution program called Seeds of Peace, because I believe in dialogue between people. And we worked with Israeli youth and Palestinian youth, bringing them together to break down stereotypes, to promote listening to the other side, in the hope that we would foster a new generation that could create peace in this region of the world. I didn't last more than a year with this organization, and it's not because I don't believe in dialogue anymore, but because I believe that people need to take action against injustice and not just talk about it. And in my position at Seeds of Peace, I couldn't take action. I only had to foster dialogue. This is also what happened in the period between 1993 and 2000. In September 13th, 1993, when Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands on the White House lawn, the whole world hailed it as a new era. We're entering a time of peace. And people did believe. But then for those 7 years, while the world talked about peace, everything but justice was being implemented on the ground. More land, Palestinian land, continued to be confiscated. The number of settlers doubled in the occupied territories. More land was taken away to build bypass roads for these settlements. They don't have to go through Palestinian towns. They can use these other roads to get to their settlements. And these bypass roads were built on Palestinian land. And Palestinians were working towards peace in which these settlements would be dismantled. Why are you continuing to take our land? Checkpoints were popping up. That's when Gaza was closed off. Gaza became one of the largest prisons in the world when it was sealed off and suddenly Palestinians couldn't leave anymore. But not only in Gaza, Jerusalem was sealed off. Suddenly, if you wanted to go from Bethlehem to Ramallah, you needed permission from the Israeli military, and this permission was hard to come by. And very rarely did it come. The economy didn't improve for Palestinians, except for the tourism industry, which improved a little bit. After the peace deal was signed with Jordan and Israel, Jordanian business improved. Less work was going to the average Palestinian laborer. Palestinians were saying, hey, wait a minute. But this was shadowed by peace. We're working towards peace and we will negotiate this. Meanwhile, facts were created on the ground that were not leading to justice. And so it became quickly obvious to Palestinians that occupation is being cemented here under the... When Ariel Sharon stepped foot in the Temple Mount, September of 2000, that was just the last straw. And then probably all of you remember the protests that were ignited. 7 Palestinians were killed on the first day, and demonstrations took to the streets, but they were responded to by military force. The Israeli army was cocking their M16, bringing in their tanks and their armored personnel carriers. And when people were being shot, you remember reports were coming out that Palestinians were being shot and killed. They were being shot or killed by bullets to the chest and head overwhelmingly. People started staying home. And the Intifada, or this uprising, an armed characteristic. It was those in Palestinian guns that were using them and aiming at settlements, aiming at the army. And the result was more military might. Those of us that are young and naive, if you will, this is what someone that was active in the first Intifada told me. Maybe it's you, young and naive, that didn't live through the first Intifada and the devastation and the weariness of so many years of struggle that you must continue to or move the struggle forward, because most people are tired and most people don't see a way that will win. Nonviolence is not something new in Palestinian society. In fact, it's been practiced for many, many years, and the first Intifada was only... But when the situation kept getting worse, most stopped organizing. We're more concerned with just day-to-day. And so we thought, we racked our brain for a reason, some kind of hope, some kind of anything, to push people to believe that we still must continue organizing despite all the odds, despite the violence that we're facing. And so we thought international civilians could really help, one, by providing a level of protection for people. Because Palestinians, they know very well that their lives aren't worth anything to the Israeli military. There's no one to hold Israel accountable for Palestinian lives, and all they have to say was it's some terrorist, and that's it, they're just numbers. Palestinians still are privileged in that sense because you have governments that are responsible for you. And it would be a PR disaster for Israel to kill an international because then they would have to prove it. As we've seen this month when a UN worker and British national Ian Hook was shot dead in Benin, I'm sure you all heard about it. We all heard about it, we all know. But you don't hear about this if it's Palestinian. internationals could provide protection. Two, internationals could turn the eye of the media that it was the real source of violence. When you have Italians marching with Palestinians, the Italian media will be interested. Like, why are you as an Italian here? Why are you here? And so internationals could give book to Palestinians. Three, internationals can, I'm speaking to you tonight, internationals that have been go back with the stories of what they've experienced and could share it. Because even if it's one by one that we have to open the eyes of people and bring the true message across, we will do it. And I hope it's not long, but someday the world will look back and recognize what a grave was committed while we were silent. And maybe they'll say, if only we knew. And we're trying to make people, let people know. Internationals can help globalize our struggle, which we believe it's a global one. I think out there people think the struggle is Palestinian versus Israeli, Muslim versus Jew. Palestinians want to push the Jews into the sea. Palestinians want the blood of Jews. And it's not true, but who is to hear us that it's not true? Internationals coming to stand with us and actually linking their hands with ours and marching could say that this is a global struggle for freedom and justice. And therefore, anyone that demands justice all over the world can join. And probably the most important thing, I know it's what drives me to continue organizing internationals to come over. It is the hope given to Palestinians, the hope that we are seeing what's happening. We are going to help get the message across. You're not being killed and oppressed without the world watching. A number of occasions. That Palestinians might not believe we will help lead to an end to the occupation, but you're helping us believe that we're not alone. And I can't express the gratitude to you. Palestinian, when he looks at an international, an American or an Italian, that has left the comfort of his or her own home to face the violence that they face every day, it really means a lot. When I was participating in the Olive Harvest campaign, one thing that I was organizing, building of this wall that the Israeli government is building, they call it the security wall. It's supposed to provide security for Israeli citizens by building a wall in between and the occupied Palestinian territories. But in the words Palestinian, this is not a security wall and will not provide for this. This wall is being built only to continue sowing the seeds of hatred between Israelis and Palestinians, between cousins that must live together. And we can see it's not a security wall because it's cutting into Palestinian territory. In the area that I was in, a little town called Jayus, about 3,000 people live in Jayus. It's a farming community. It's in the region of Qalqilia, and Qalqilia is fertile of Palestinian land. Almost everybody here is a farmer, lives off their fruit trees, lives off their olive trees, lives off their vegetables. This wall is going to cut into Jayus. Out of 13,000 dunams, which is roughly, so you can make the equation, 1 acre equals 4 dunams. Jayus is 13,000 dunams, already been flattened. That means olive trees have been ripped out and the land completely flattened because this is where the wall is going to come through. And this wall is 8 meters high, 24 feet high. Heavily, every 100 meters or so, there's going to be an Israeli watchtower. Not only is there a wall, but before the wall, you have a trench, deep trench dug all the way, and then you have an area of land that's flat, that's going to be used for detecting footprints. So before and after the wall, you have mass areas of land that have been flattened. 600 dunams have already been flattened. And then out of the 12,400 dunams that are left, 9,000 are going to fall on the other side of the wall. So the Jayus residents can't get to their land anymore. The Israeli army says that there's going to be a gate that Palestinians can go through. Well, I can tell you, for example, in India, in Kalkir, the city is going to be completely encircled by this wall. Completely. Only one gate is going to be available for them to exit and enter from, and this gate is going to be manned by Israeli soldiers. And if that wasn't bad enough, I can tell you what it's like approaching Israeli soldiers, because we see it at checkpoints every day. Palestinian, especially men, but all, have to stop at a distance away, whatever is determined by the soldiers. They have to put their bags down, lift their hands, turn around, lift their shirts, and sometimes pull on their pants. That's before they can approach, and this is all under the barrel of a gun. And then they can slowly approach, and they turn over their ID cards. And if they have special permission to pass, and if they don't, they're turned away. And if soldiers feel like it, they'll detain you. It really doesn't take any longer than, if we're going to agree that soldiers need to check IDs, it takes about 20 minutes. But usually the soldiers detain Palestinians for up to 2-3 hours at a time, sometimes 6-7 hours. Or a Palestinian leaving at 7 o'clock in the morning to try to get to work in the next town over might not be released till sunset, and they're forced to go back home. And so that'll be what it's like if they're going to utilize this gate that's going to be opened for them so graciously so they can move around. When I was in Jayus, we brought internationals and we met with the village, with council, and we planned demonstrations and protests. We planned to form a human chain and put our bodies in front of the bulldozers that were working only meters, and we did. And we managed to stop the bulldozers for a few days. On one of the last demonstrations that I was in before I had to leave to come here, we marched, about 200 of us, and we stopped the bulldozers, but then the army stood in front of us. It was a Friday, so 200 Palestinians prayed on this land that had already been flattened. And after prayers, they had 15 minutes to leave. Of course, we decided we weren't going to leave. So the bulldozers can start working again? No. So we sat down. And then they started at us with the tear gas. And when people were withdrawing away from the tear gas, the army started moving forward, firing rubber-coated steel bullets and live ammunition. And so the internationals that were there got in front of the soldiers in order to stop them at the Palestinians that were retreating. Internationals, the soldiers came after them and detained them. I got away and was trying to continue filming. But something that we had discussed the night before, that no matter how much we're provoked, we're not going to throw stones, stones started flying. And I was very upset. But the next night when we met again with the Palestinians, the youth and the organizers, and they were so depressed and apologetic about the internationals that had been arrested on their behalf, and they said, "We tried. We tried to throw stones so the soldiers could come after us and leave the internationals alone, but it didn't work." And that's how appreciative Palestinians are for anyone that will come and stand with them. That they were trying to protect us when we were trying to protect them. But the important thing is that we were standing together against an injustice. And till now, I mean, the work continues. We're not stopping. Since April, we've had a call out for internationals to keep coming. We have campaigns when we can, but you don't have to come during a campaign. We are trying to maintain a constant presence in certain areas, areas that are most heavily affected, and internationals are being worn thin. So we are reaching out for more people to continue coming. I can tell you, in Nablus, where we've kept a constant presence, the people, the constant presence since about April, the Palestinians organizing, mobilizing there to defy the occupation. From going out into the streets in times of curfew, roadblocks that are set up to prevent their movement, to mass demonstrations for the right to education, to the extent that on days when there was a heavy military presence and 24-hour curfew in the streets, all the residents of Nablus came out, took their children to work. And this defiance continues. Yesterday, they organized to remove two of the lots in Nablus. This meant bringing in a bulldozer under the watchful eye of the Israeli military, but internationals accompanied them, and so even if they were to be attacked, there were to be cameras there. Even if they were risking their lives, at least people were going to see. We're still organizing to oppose this wall, and there's another demonstration in 2 days' time where internationals will accompany the residents of these villages that are being most heavily affected, and they will march. We're planning an active summer campaign that we're hoping to get over 1,000 people to come join us. It'll be a national campaign. I speak as a Palestinian. That's why I say we a lot. This will be a Palestinian campaign, and we're inviting internationals to come join us. If you have any spare time to come and see what it's like, we need you. You know, I've been asked on a number of occasions, are you naive? Do you think you're a little bit naive? And I say, if being naive is believing that justice can prevail on earth, then I'm happy to be naive. And I always wear a button on my bag that says, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. And so that's what I spend every day and night trying to get across. And I only believe, I don't even look at the negotiations anymore. There's negotiations here or there, or there's secret talks. I don't care. Because it's got to be, I'm sick of waiting for the politicians. And it's got to be the people that make change. And I'm telling you as a Palestinian that we need your voice with ours. We really don't believe we can do it alone for many different reasons. But more than that, I believe voices of justice and reason are stronger because we're more than the people that act on self-interest. And so if we can just unite all these voices. And so as a Palestinian, I can give you this message from Palestinians. If you will come and put your hand in ours and march with us and shout out with us against occupation and against oppression, then our voices will ring louder than those voices that seek to maintain. And even the people that are covering their ears because they don't want to hear from another will hear our voices ringing through. I want to end only because I add them a little, some time to talk, not a little bit. And more importantly, I want to leave time for your questions and answers because I want to help. I want to work together with you in order to figure out how we can beat this oppression, how we can bring down the occupation. If you want to come to Palestine, I want to tell you how. If I want to tell you what you can do here. So thank you much for listening. I'll answer a lot of those questions in the question and answer period. Again, thank you so much. Palestinians all the time say, for every new person that comes, and especially if they're Americans, I can tell you we hate American foreign policy and we know that America is funding the military, suppressing us, but when American civilians come, we always say, which means welcome. So hopefully I'm welcoming you into our struggle. So ahlan wa sahlan, and here's Adam.
First of all, I apologize for the music that started on new computer, new projector for me to use, and a little technical difficulties. But I hope you saw from some of the pictures we showed, some of the things that Huwaida was talking about, these were some of the pictures that we were able to bring back from Jayus, from the wall, from the earlier campaigns we showed. While she was talking about Jenin, I just want to point out those were pictures from the Jenin refugee camp and the destruction that there was taken. We were both there and visited the camp and were able to take those photos ourselves and to visit people of Jenin camp. And there was a point that I brought up earlier which I want to sort of get back to, which is the Palestinian people know that the world has seen some of the most horrific things that have happened to them. Everybody knows that CNN covered Jenin, that MSNBC covered Jenin. In fact, I think those stations even gave it like a little title. You know, we have the war in Iraq today, or different, you know, like headings that go under the news pieces. And I think even Jenin got one. And to this day, the rubble that you saw in the pictures still stands in the same place. It exists that way, not because the people don't start recovering whatever they can of their lives, property, but because they can't get permission from the Israeli government to bring in trucks to remove that rubble. They can't get the camp is a UN camp, refugee camp, and the UN can't get permission to bring in trucks and remove the rubble. And so the people are sort of the people in the camp are caught. Stands in the same place, untouched. It exists that way, not because the people don't want to start recovering whatever they can of their lives and of their property, but because they can't get permission from the Israeli government to bring in trucks to remove that rubble. They can't, the UN can't get, the camp is a UN camp, basically, refugee camp, and the UN can't get permission to bring in trucks and remove the rubble. And so the people are sort of, the people in the camp are caught in this terrible, ongoing trauma, not just because the Israeli army continues to fly Apache helicopters and F-16s over the camp, and to bring in troops and tanks and armored personnel carriers into the city and the camp almost every day, but the state of the Jenin camp after the horrific invasion exists to this day untouched virtually. I know, as I saw the destruction of the city I lived in Ramallah, and I witnessed as street after street after street and building after building developed chickenpox, holes in these buildings, scars, some buildings just completely flattened, how I felt, and this wasn't, you know, I had only lived in Ramallah for about a total of a year and a half, this, or maybe not even that much. It wasn't my home. I come from Brooklyn. It was my temporary home for sure, but still, I felt something, but I knew that that something I felt could in no way compare to what the Palestinians, my neighbors, felt. And this wasn't, of course, the first time for them. And perhaps that is one of the biggest crimes that has sort of gone on, that everybody's sort of aware of, but hasn't really been voiced too well. And that is that most of the attacks that the Israeli army is carrying out, most of the sieges, most of the occupation of homes, the destruction of homes, most of the men being rounded up, most of the children being shot, all come from the refugee camps. Now, it's true, all of the cities are enduring ongoing military reoccupation, but the hardest hit places in all of these places, in all of these cities, are the refugee camps. These are people who have been forced out of their homes in 1948, in 1967. Now we have people being exiled from the West Bank to Gaza. Internal displacement, I guess. And it's these people who have to keep on re-enduring over and over and over. And yet, every time I've gone to a camp, and where I lived in Ramallah, there were two refugee camps. One was literally out my door and down the street, the Kadora refugee camp, and then there was the Amari refugee camp, which was maybe a 5-minute walk from my house. And any time I would go there, even if it was just walking, especially the Kadora camp, which is a very small refugee camp, and it sort of straddled one of the main streets between where the hospital was, which is where my apartment was, and spent a lot of time over there, to the main area of Ramallah City. Every time walking through, people shouting hello to me, inviting me in for tea or coffee. Couldn't ever walk down that street, not once, not even after the hardest hit days. That even when there were tanks still rolling around the city and people would just come out and sit in the street while the tanks were in other parts of the city, knowing eventually they'd have to run back inside when the tanks came, people always calling me over and asking me how I was doing, making sure I was safe, to see if I wanted anything, if I needed anything. That to me showed the resilience. I mean, that was the resilience of the Palestinian people. There's this concept or sort of characteristic of the Palestinian people that has informed their resistance and their struggle, which is the concept of samud in Arabic, which means basically steadfastness in English. And I used to hear about this before I lived in the occupied territories. I used to hear about this concept, and I was part of the resistance, and something that fed the resistance and fed the struggle of the Palestinian people. And I used to think it was sort of a cop-out, that it was weak, that it sort of was a way of just, okay, yes, it's endurance, but you know, it's relying on it too much prevents more concrete action, more strategic action. And from living there, I can tell you I've developed my own endurance, my own steadfastness, sort of as a Palestinian, I guess, if they will have me, because you understand that to an extent survival is very much winning, or at the very least achieving one goal, which is survival. It is true, absolutely horrific attacks are taking place continuously against Israeli civilians. Continuously being every, you know, I guess maybe in the most intense period there were 6 bombings in a period of 2 weeks. And that was extremely intense. And I know from having Israeli friends and having spent a lot of time in Israeli cities how disconcerting it is to just even walk by a bus or to stop in a place for a cup of coffee. But on the Palestinian side, in the Palestinian streets, every single day is a day in hell, essentially. Every single day there's somebody you know, somebody down the street from you, some cousin, some friend, some business associate who's been shot, or whose child has been shot, or arrested, whose whereabouts are completely unknown because the Israelis won't give any information about where that person is being held or where that person is being taken, and forget any sort of family visits to these people. First of all, they're not even considered, you know, they're not filed for the first 3 months. You can be arrested in by the Israeli military or police for 3 months if you're a Palestinian and not face any charges. Just sit around lingering in jail. And family have no idea. And that's one of the reasons why we don't know to date who were killed in Jenin. Because there are so many men still missing from that time. And for sure, some of them are sitting in Israeli jails, but nobody knows. The international community, the UBAS, can't get accurate information. Just walking in the streets, first of all, if curfew is lifted, then you can walk in the streets relatively safely. Though there have been people shot by Israeli snipers when curfew even has been lifted. In fact, one of the tactics that the army's been using in a place like Jenin has been to lift curfew, wait for the people to feel comfortable and come out into the streets, and then invade the city with a lightning strike invasion of armored personnel carriers and tanks, and hunt down people that they want. And inevitably during these times, children are shot and killed. One image of children that always gets shown on the news, seeing children, is the children who go out and throw stones against the soldiers. And I guess it was during the First Intifada that provoked a lot of questioning, even in Israel, while shooting against these children who only have stones in their heads. Well, somehow that has changed, and over time, over the last 10 years or so, these children have become a great threat, even with the same stones. And so it's now pretty much, and basically since the beginning of the Intifada, it's been relatively acceptable in Israeli society for these children to be shot. And now the answer is, well, where are their mothers? Obviously their mothers are sending them out to do this. Their fathers are sending them out because they're afraid to fight. So they'll send children instead. This is sort of the mentality that feeds acceptance of what is happening. And I spent a lot of time with these children in Ramallah who would go out and throw stones against the soldiers and in part trying to bear witness, in part trying to at times be a form of protection, and really at times actually trying to understand because I couldn't understand why these kids, what they thought they were doing, throwing stones against these big, huge tanks and soldiers who were armed with crazy weapons. And they know, I mean, they have their whole routine down. They'll approach up to a certain point, and they know when the soldiers will start firing. And you should see when one of them gets hit, they rally better than any paramedics I've seen, and they pick up the kid, and, you know, probably not in the best way of handling a shot person, but bring them back to the, you know, to safety, where medical personnel can take care of them, and then they're back doing it again. And they can all see their scars. And I met one little boy who was taller than this, honestly, and I don't even know how old he was because it's hard to judge age and height. But we used to see him out there throwing stones. He was the smallest kid, and then he wasn't around for a while, and then we saw him again. But he had been shot, and he showed us quite proudly where his scar was. And the other kids treated him with a lot of respect. And I started to get an understanding about it, though, from the kids. And it wasn't so much that they thought they could win. They're not silly, but, you know, stupid. They're raised in a very difficult environment. They're not sent out there by their parents, by the way. Often, parents are dealing with other children in the household. Often, parents are dealing with the trauma of their own existence and the conditions. And it's very difficult to keep track of all the time. And I guess what it was hope. Somehow it would have an impact somewhere on somebody, that the stones that they were throwing, the symbolic act of resistance that they were engaged in, would somehow empower them and empower their movement to the point where the soldiers would just leave. Another act that kids used to do all the time during the summer, during curfew, that didn't get reported in the news, was that kids all over the West Bank would fly their kites in the afternoons when the winds would pick up. And they would defy curfew and go out into the streets in their little neighborhoods, and they would make kites that looked like the Palestinian flag, or in the colors of the Palestinian flag, or were actually replicas of the Palestinian flag. And they would fly them high in the sky, knowing full well that everywhere around the city, in Ramallah, for instance, there were Israeli soldiers driving around. All they had to do was look up in the sky, and it was filled with kites. And in fact, in some places, the kids wanted to make sure that their kite got right above the house. They triangulated it without a geo-satellite system, I don't know, to get right above the house where Israeli soldiers were occupying, so that the soldiers knew that there was a Palestinian flag above their house. This also was a form, I believe, of hope, a symbolic act of setting their nation free to fly over the land. And that's really where I found a lot of inspiration and hope myself. I do believe that the Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian children, have been extremely traumatized. I know it. I myself have been traumatized by my experience there. But I also know from living there that the experience of this trauma over and over after decades can be mitigated by the hope that the Palestinians maintain. And it's not a hope based on any sort of blind faith. They know that Israel is not going to be convinced by the goodness of their cause to walk away from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They know that there are significant interests in Israel that wish to hold on to these places, that wish to dominate the Palestinian people. They also know that the United States, particularly post September 11th, and particularly with the war against Iraq, is not particularly concerned about the Palestinian people or about establishing peace in this region. And I think that's why we've been so able to find a welcome mat of sorts when the International Solidarity Movement was founded and started bringing people over. It was because this, in a sense, was one of the few tangible ways that hope was being realized and materialized. All of a sudden, or not quite all of a sudden, but with a lot of hard work and planning and talking, we had international civilians all over the occupied territories. In Gaza, in Rafah, the most sort of the ends of the earth, the worst place, probably even worse than Jenin, to be in the occupied territories. We had, throughout the summer, internationals who were down there when homes were being bulldozed, row by row by row. And so I believe that we're now at a point where our resource as international activists can generate, help to generate, and build on the hope that exists, a new movement in the occupied territories, a new movement among the Palestinians. I think, and I know from my discussions with people, and I know from what's being talked about in the Palestinian territories, that a nonviolent, strategic nonviolent movement that is national in scope, that incorporates all elements of Palestinian society, we're getting close to that point where it's going to emerge. It needs more resources, of course. And one of those resources is us as international activists who go. And us as international activists who spread the word here in the States and who take the pictures that are emailed back and who take the video and spread it around and educate other people. I have a friend, just a little sidebar, I have a friend who wrote a poem, a Jewish American woman who wrote a poem, and she's also very active, and she's married to a Palestinian as well, and she wrote a poem called What More Is There to Say, and it was sort of a diatribe against, aimed at a lot of Jewish Americans who are liberal on so many other causes, but when it comes to this one can't see past, you know, this wall of Israeli security without recognizing at all that there are people on the other side. And she goes on, and it captures a lot of how I also feel sometimes talking to a lot, not just Jewish Americans, but a lot of Americans and others about this issue. But I think one point, and I talked to her about this, that is missing is that our words do matter. The Israelis know it. And that's one of the reasons why they're trying to keep us out. Over the past few months, we've seen an escalating attempt by the Israelis to prevent activists from coming, to prevent journalists from going to certain places and interviewing certain people and seeing for themselves and taking pictures and sending video back of what is actually happening. So we know that words and pictures and ideas matter to Israel. And we need to exploit that as much as possible, because I do believe that the more people know, the more accurate information coming back from first-hand accounts on the ground from people like us who can address people, other people like us in our own communities in this country, to tell them what we've seen and what we've witnessed and what we've experienced, the more change we can make. And I think a change will come. This summer we're planning a campaign called Freedom Summer. It's our second Freedom Summer. I thought we'd be finished with freedom after the first summer, but we weren't. And so we have to keep going, so this is Freedom Summer 2. And I hope it doesn't turn into like the Super Bowl where we get to 30 or 40, but we're trying to get 2,000 activists to the West Bank and Gaza Strip this summer. And from all over the world, if we get more, excellent. Because we want to start moving beyond sort of reactive actions, which has been sort of, to an extent, what we've been doing, to something that's more proactive, and to take the real initiative with our Palestinian partners, hand in hand, together with them, and for instance, go up to and march on a settlement and say, go back to Israel. And I'm sure once we do that, and if we do that, we will have our fellow Israeli activists who are out there also in the olive fields with us, who are now starting to become more active in this kind of action. And then I think the end will be near. I see you all in the occupied territory. Some of us, like myself, need to change our name to get back there, but we will. And I encourage you I'll have Paul Larudi, who's one of our local ISM activists, come up here and tell you about a meeting coming up here in the Bay Area if you're interested in going to Palestine and joining the ISM. But before that, right before Paul speaks, I just want to have Ted come up here as a few announcements to make. And thank you all for coming out tonight.
Help out. If you need to write a check, I think there's a there's a non-profit named Blue W Prophetic. Okay. So if you want to make a check out to the Jerusalem Fund, you've got the tax deductible contribution. So please help out and call the room from the local ISM and tell us about what's coming up.
Thank you. As Admiral Wida and Ted have said, there are various ways that you can help. We have a fairly active local group. I'm very proud to say that from the Bay Area in the last year, we're trying to figure out exactly how many have gone, but it's between 50 and 30 people have gone from the Bay Area to Palestine. And we have had a constant presence from the Bay Area in Palestine since about late March of last year, except maybe for a couple of weeks. And that deserves your applause. The most powerful way that you can help, of course, is to come yourself. And this local organ, the ISM support group of Northern California, can help you do that. Just get in touch with us, then pick up one of these, which is on the table back there. We're having a meeting at the Campus Action Network office at 1605 Ashby in Berkeley on the 16th of this month. We have meetings at least once a month, if not more often. And we have a very fine training program that prepares you to go to Palestine and take the training right there before you go into the field. It's all, and first, another thing is, thanks to the generosity of you and others, we will have some funds available. To subsidize trips on a priority basis. But there are other ways that you can help. You don't have to go to college. You can help support our group here. One of the problems that we've had with the support group here is that some of our people are always in Palestine. And the people who have important jobs to do here, what happens to the job? We need people who stay here. So if you can't go, you can help us that way. Another way, of course, is anything you can do to help us with the fundraising. And also, speaking events. We have 50 of these people here who have experiences and they're dying to talk about it. So find us speaking events. If you have a group or something, you'd be passionate to take care of it. And the contact information is here. Two other things I just want to mention. One is this really groundbreaking book, in a sense. It's one of the great books that's come out lately, extremely timely, about what in Israel, the power structure of it's called Israel Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. It was only written in July and it was in the stores in October by Tanya Reinhardt, a researcher at the University of Tel Aviv. And it's cheap, and we have it back on the table there. Really shocking what it tells us about the motivation and the intentions, the secret intentions of the people who are pulling the strings behind what you read in the news. The other one is No One Need Cry. This was filmed by a filmmaker who was in Jenin. This deserves to be shown on network television on 60 Minutes. It was filmed in Jenin. It's the survivors in massacre telling their own story. And this was filmed 4 to 10 days after the ending of the siege of Jenin. It's a very powerful film, especially if you have an event where you want to film yourself to the show. So we have these events. So thank you very much. Please, I look forward to hearing. And there's a sign-up sheet going around if you want to us to get in touch with you as well. Thank you.
All right. I think we have some time for questions and answers. Just one point in the back. There are two tables: one for the ISM, the local ISM group, and also one for Global Exchange, who's one of the co-hosts for tonight. So if you want more information on Global Exchange, you can check out the information back there. So I guess we have time for a few questions. If no questions, I could go eat. Ma'am, maybe stand up. Thank you.
Several questions. One is, okay, when you say come, go back to Israel, Israel, Palestinian terrorists.
Let me answer your first one, and then I think I need clarification on your second one. As a Palestinian, I could tell you we're never going to forget our historic homeland, which includes Haifa, which includes Yaffa, which includes Acre. And there are almost 4 million refugees that were kicked out or escaped also that aren't going to forget their homes and in fact are waiting to come home back to their. However, in 1988, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which is the official representative of Palestinians, acknowledged Israel's right to exist on 78% of historic Palestine, leaving Palestinians the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, 22% of historic Palestine. This was reaffirmed in the signing of the Oslo Accords, and this has become officially what the PLO is negotiating for. An end to the occupation based on the 1967 borders, based on UN Resolutions 242 and 338. It takes two forms, and indeed there are two kinds of debates going on, whether we want to establish and create a Palestinian West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, or whether it would not be better for Israelis and Palestinians, for Jews, Christians, and Muslims to exist in one, you call it whatever you want to call it, but with equal rights for all, one person, one vote. Now, many Palestinians, and it's increasing, there was a poll taken a few months ago that showed about 30% of Palestinians approve of the one-state solution and would favor the one-state. This is a very high number, considering some of the, I mean, all of the talks in the nationalism about creating a Palestinian state, and that's on the rise. There is a study that came out by the Negotiations Affairs Department of the PLO that says the two-state solution is almost dead with everything else has created. We don't necessarily take a position on that. I can tell you like what my position is, and different people can tell you what their position is. I can tell you the ISF takes the position that, or what we're struggling for, is freedom for the Palestinian people based on UN resolutions and international law. So that requires Israel pulling out of Palestinian territories, of fulfilling UN resolutions, heading by international law, and then whether one state or two states comes out of talks left up to the negotiators. In general, there is a feeling that a Palestinian state needs to be developed first or established first, and then in the long run it will turn into one state because it's with people economically and otherwise. The land is too small, the resources are few. But right now, Israel is the main obstacle to that because they insist on Israel being defined as a Jewish state. And therefore, even the Palestinians that have Israeli citizenship, there's about 1 million, like my father, that have Israeli citizenship. And you hear that Israel is a democracy and these people are allowed to vote and everything, but it's a gross discrimination that goes on in there. And the parties that participate in the legislature, the Knesset, that advocate for one person, one vote, a democratic state for all its people, an end to occupation, just last week they were barred from the elections. Two parties and two prominent members that were Palestinian contingent inside Israel were barred because they are saying one person, one state, and no to the discrimination. But this is a threat to the state of Israel as far as, you know, the hardliners and the administration goes, and so they were barred from the elections. So when we say that settlers should go home, that this, all the settlements that were created on occupied territory as is acknowledged by UN resolutions, the PLO did recognize the right of the State of Israel to exist. And so no one's calling for the annihilation of the State of Israel. We'd hope that it will be a true democracy. Once refugees can come back to their lands, is definitely hoped for and worked towards. And again, I can tell you that I'm not going to forget where my father came from, and the 4 million refugees aren't going to forget the homes that they lost. But that's what we're moving towards, is a state of either two states or one. And if it's decided by the parties that it's two states, it needs to exist on 78% of historic Palestine. And I didn't understand your second question. I'm sorry. Right. That's true. I mean, we've talked to many soldiers that truly believe that what they're doing is affecting their families inside Israel. What we're saying and what we've been trying to get them to see is by maintaining, continuing to oppress a people is not going to lead to security. By denying people the basic rights, the right to live, by stripping people of their dignity, by preventing people from travel, by cutting off their survival, their food, that is not going to provide for the security of the state of Israel. Ending occupation, recognizing people working towards true peace based on justice, is going to secure the safety and the security of Israelis. Unfortunately, not many people see that, and they believe only in using might. But I don't know any case where you oppress and squash a people continually and that they won't resist, that people will not, the people will just give into this and give up resisting this. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but in brief, the only thing that will bring security to the state of Israel is removing the settlements, removing the checkpoints, ending the occupation. I'll go this way.
They're not just cutting up, they're teaching themselves in. Like
About your second point, I agree with you. About the first point, what is the point of having two states? I would say that in the current reality we have right now, and we exist only in the current. I don't see how we can get to a one-state equality-for-all solution out of this current reality. We have to change the current reality, and I think the change that has to happen is that we have to see Palestinian nationalism realized, because it is a force. It has credibility and tangibility with a lot of people in the realization of a... And, you know, you said, well, we know what security... what it means, like, that Israel won't let it be free. Well, that doesn't necessarily... mean what two states mean. Two states can mean independent states. Now, I agree. I think what the negotiators have been willing to accept and what they've been talking about has not been equal to the hopes, aspirations, and even minimum acceptance level for most Palestinians. But I would also say that I think that there is still one perhaps growing divide even inside the Palestinian community at this point. And I think it's evident your position, but your position isn't alone, and I also know that a different position than yours among Palestinians is that there is a divide in Palestinian thought what should be the answer. And I think that Palestinians need to speak to each other more now than ever, perhaps refugees, people living in Lebanon, in the camps in this country, in France, in Europe, in Australia, in Israel, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, in the West Bank and Gaza, need to all speak together so that there can be one vision. It doesn't have one voice, but I think what's most important now is that there needs to be a vision of what the future is for the Palestinian people, and I think that's missing right now. That's just fine. Somebody over here is next.
How quick are you?
It differs. It really does. And we go through that, like in the different trainings and orientations that we give. There has been a lot of ruckus raised about supporting human rights workers and peace activists, etc. And most recently, when a Canadian activist tried to come in, and they just barred him from coming in and put him in this detention center and said, "You are shipped back to Canada." We got a lawyer on it, and he actually won the case and was given the right to stay temporarily inside Israel to go to the West Bank and Gaza because it was too dangerous for him. Anyway, he defied this ban in the end, and he is now in Nablus. But also when we had in the protest I was telling you about in Jayus, when we had the activists arrested, they were told that they were, and we got a lawyer on that also who took it to court. And the Ministry of Interior said that they needed to be deported, their visas needed to be revoked because they were arrested. And the Supreme Court said, the Israeli Supreme Court said that's ridiculous, and they were not deported in the end. However, the Israeli ministry hates the ISM. They are doing everything they can to try to keep people out, but we do give you tips on how to come in. Less so with soldiers on the ground, and you will. And it really, fortunately, since they've started with the mass deportations, the internationals they're a little bit more cautious about what they do now. Like before, matter internationals would get arrested, but now it's like we'll get arrested and we could. That's always decided like within the context of whatever action with conferring with both your group and with the Palestinians, and you'll see what it's worth. We've been able, since April, we've had about 50 people deported. But since April, we've had almost 1,000 people come in and stay in till their scheduled time of leave. So I can't necessarily tell you how long it would be. Sometimes we've been surprised, like when he was arrested, and that night they revoked his visa, and it just kept him in jail for 5 days, and then shipped him out. And then in other cases, they've detained people and then let them go. So we just have to measure each situation, but I don't think it should be a deterrence for people coming. Over here.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just asking Adam, and we have forgot to bring our flyers, which have our information. And so I'm so sorry. Those of you that are writing can write this down. Our website's probably the best source of information for people that seek to find out alone about how to come. But actually, you have a great resource here, which is the Northern California ISM support group, because they have been very active in helping people to come by raising money, providing a local orientation support group when you're over there. But check out our website, because you'll see stories from people written that have gone there. There will be an ISM handbook, which tells you what you need to know, from what to do at the airport to possibly what to pack with you. And website is www.palsolidarity.org. And you can even sign up in the upper right-hand corner to receive our updates, which is about one a day or so, if they're releases or personal stories. Oh, PAL Solidarity, PALSOLIDARITY.ORG, PALSOLIDARITY.ORG. Yeah, it's possible as far as like radio and television. Even sometimes when electricity is not cut, a lot of people have access to it, and telephones, and the way that information spreads, it's pretty impressive. What's the bigger obstacle is people's fear, but not fear of actually dying or getting injured for the cause, because that's unquestioned. But it's fear that they will be injured or killed for nothing, because whatever Israel's response will be, you know, no one will mobilize against it, no one will hold Israel accountable. So that's what we're kind of working on in providing a presence, and to try to get our governments and the United Nations to uphold their obligations to protect the Palestinian people, to treat them as protected persons. The kind of unity of all the Palestinians. In all the West Bank, very possibly. I could just tell you the skepticism. Just to tell you, for example, after some marches, after speaking to groups and Palestinian local councils and things, I always have people come up to me and say, do you think this will really change anything? So it's really just years of trying all this. This is, you know, this kind of unity and mass breakings of curfew, they occurred all the time during the first Intifada. All the time. You know, during the first Intifada, people would, and there would be leaflets, there would be small meetings, there were popular committees that existed in almost every neighborhood, in every Palestinian town, village, and refugee camp, and there would be meetings, secret meetings, and then they would pass on, you know, their ideas and decisions, Intifada leadership, which would then release the next course of action. Stores, for example, they would reverse break curfew. You know, they would be allowed to open from 8 to 5, for example, and they would decide we're closing at 12 today, and they would close their shops, which would really irritate the Israeli soldiers, who would go around breaking all locks and forcing stores to open, and they would just come back and close their shops again, sometimes close their shops in March. You know, they organized in Beit Sahur mass tax resistance. They refused to pay taxes. Then, and people suffered. They had all of their belongings confiscated by the Israeli military because they refused to pay their taxes. But these kinds of things happened all the time during the First Intifada. And so those people that were so active then and did this are now like, do you really think it's going to lead to anything? That's what we're working to. That's my, you know, as a Palestinian, biggest struggle. As a young and naive Palestinian, thinking, yes, we can do it, but it's like, why can we do it? And why will it work? So I do agree that that would be very powerful, but it's working on making the people believe that it will be powerful. I lost who's up and down. I think you've had your hand up for a while. Yeah, actually, there. I haven't seen the wall in Gaza myself, but it has and is being built the same. I speak more passionately about the wall in the West Bank because I've been there, but it is being built in Gaza. It's being built around Jerusalem also. I've seen parts of it from Ramallah, where they have the Qalandia checkpoint around Bethlehem. So basically to block these Palestinian areas from Jerusalem and to section Jerusalem off. And then in the West Bank, it's supposed to be built along the Green Line, the 1967 borders, but as it's coming down, it cuts into the most fertile of Palestinian land. And it's going to effectively, after it's done being built, going to effectively annex about 10% of West Bank land. I mean, even right now, it's isolating and or destroying 200 greenhouses, 7 underground water wells that are used to irrigate Palestinian crops, 15,000 orange trees, in addition to all the land I talked about. And it's being drawn not only to take up these valuable resources, but to annex into Israel some of the settlements that they have illegally built in this area. So... I don't know if you can make copies, but let me give you a website that you can read more about the wall by a Palestinian organization, umbrella organization that was created to basically fight the wall. It's called PENGON. So you go to www.pengon.org, and that's the Palestinian Environmental NGO Network, PENGON.org. And they have a lot of information about what's happening on that website. Oh no, okay, I think we only have time for about one more question and then we can stay after to answer. Oh, I'm sorry. It is so important. It's unquestioned, we give $2.2 billion to the Israeli military per year. And now they're asking for an additional $14 billion, $4 billion which will go to military aid, and then $10 billion in loan guarantees, etc., that will be used towards their economy, to help improve their economy. So, and settlements, unfortunately, because a great deal of the Israeli budget is spent on these settlements. So it is so important. And Congress every year passes this unquestioned. You might have a couple of dissenters in Congress, a couple of people that will abstain, but that's it. It's unquestioned. 98% of the Senate supports this, votes yes every single year to renew this aid. And today, Israeli officials are meeting with the Bush administration about this aid. So I encourage everyone, it's really easy if you don't want to write a letter, to just pick up your phone to your member of Congress.
Actually, I would urge you not just to write your congressperson, but perhaps even, maybe even more importantly at least, is to contact also your local media and ask them to cover this. This is a new story given the state of our economy, and this is a country coming to ask us for $4 billion $4 billion in direct military aid that is being targeted against civilians. And so try and get the media also. Enough. You are all consumers of the media, you're all customers of it, papers, of the television, news. Ask them to cover this as a story because it will affect local economies everywhere.
Thanks. Sorry we didn't get to every question, but we'll stay after if anyone wants to ask us questions. So thanks again for hosting us.